Welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Ellefson with the Digital Education Podcast. Happy New Year. And for some people who think the 2020s are a start of a new decade like me, happy new decade. I'm with Corey DeAngelis again today. Corey, you've been on the podcast more than anybody else, so I really appreciate this. And I always love talking to you. Corey is the Director of School Choice at Reason Foundation. Also an adjunct scholar at Cato Institute. Corey's, you know, been on the podcast. He spoke at an event on school choice and kind of ed policy that we did in DC this past summer. His research primarily focuses on the effects of school choice programs on non-academic outcomes such as criminal activity, character skills, mental health, political participation, and schooling supply. And we've talked about that research in the past before, but Corey, it's been a busy end of 2019 for you. You kind of pointed out and created a correction on the Washington Post side. It took them a little while to get there, but you know pointed out some things, and then you also kind of were a lead and pointing out or bringing to light or however you want to say it, the paradox or contradiction in Senator Warren's school choice for her own kids versus for other kids. And so, I mean, I just want to maybe start there because, you know, just the opportunity for you to share, you know, kind of the busyness of the end of 2019 for you.
Yeah. Hey, Eric, it's very good to talk to you again. Thanks for having me back on the podcast. Hopefully you can make it up to DC sometime in the near future again, so we can hang out again. So I really enjoyed, when you came up to DC this past summer. So yeah, let's talk a little bit about, you know, what happened in the past few months. The Washington Post actually had an opinion piece run by Robert Pianta. And if you don't know who this guy is, he's actually the dean at University of Virginia's Curry School of Education. And myself and a lot of other people noticed right when the op-ed came out that Dean Pianta actually made the claim that since the late 1980s, after adjusting for inflation, real per pupil spending has actually decreased in the United States. But that is absolutely not true, no matter how you slice the data. The real per pupil expenditures in the United States since the late 1980s, even if you use the highest year of spending in the 1980s, which was 1989, there has been a real increase in per pupil spending by 36% since then. So there's no way to say that there was a decrease in per pupil expenditure since that time. Even if you look at local revenues, even if you just look at state revenues, or even if you just look at federal revenues separately, no matter how you slice the data, you cannot make that claim. So I, you know, pointed this out on Twitter, and it really got amplified. I think it went up to, you know, 780 likes or something like that on Twitter, because people understand that, look, we can disagree about whether money matters or not in education, whether we should spend more or less than we do now, but we need to be able to agree on the basic facts. Especially if you are an elite academic at an elite institution, just saying things that are not true. So I contacted an editor at the Washington Post. What was very strange to me is that it took 8 days for them to issue the correction, even though this was a verifiably false statement. There's no way that you can spin this as a true statement. So the editor was actually kind of trying to figure out any way to spin the statement when I was going back and forth with them, like maybe, you know, state percentage of the total had decreased over time, but that wasn't true either. There was no evidence for that. So it just really irked a lot of people that an elite academic got away with saying this false statement for so long. And of course, the UVA is not going to say anything about it or do anything about it. So that's one correction. Then just a week later, the Philly Inquirer said something similar. I don't know if the, and this was by a journalist, an education journalist. Juliana Reyes over at the Philly Inquirer said something along the lines of, in Pennsylvania, over the last 3 decades, we've seen drastic cuts to education funding. And that wasn't true either. There had actually been large increases in education funding over the last 3 decades. I think it was, again, in the realm of over 30% increase in inflation-adjusted per pupil spending in Pennsylvania. To give Juliana credit, at the Philly Inquirer, when I tweeted this out at first, it only took her about an hour to respond. At first she pushed back, but then I showed her how her data were actually flawed. She agreed that her data were flawed, and she corrected the statement within a couple of hours. So I was very happy with that at first. But the thing is, she changed the statement from over the last three decades to over the last decade, which was still incorrect. Over the last decade, the per pupil spending had actually increased in Pennsylvania by 17% in real terms. So then at that point, you know, it took a few more days for them to actually correct it. But the strange thing there was the story didn't change. And this was the same with the Washington Post article. The narrative stayed exactly the same, even though they got the facts completely backwards. So this is just two cases in 1 week. And I can only imagine how many times these types of things are happening. It just so happened that I came across these two articles. So I hope people are watching out for these types of claims in the future. And then also to get to Senator Warren, this was very big news in October when I found out that Senator Warren actually sent her son to a private school, Alex Warren. Alex is now around 43 years of age, but in fifth grade, he started at a private school in Austin, Texas, when Elizabeth Warren was teaching at UT Austin. He actually went to Kirby Hall School right next door to UT Austin, and that school is currently around $18,000 per year. So a very elite private school in Texas. And the strange thing is, no one had any information about this until I figured it out using Ancestry.com, using his first name, last name, date of birth, and finding the actual yearbook photo. And so Senator Warren was coming out all over Twitter and all over social media and in the news saying, look, I'm proud of public school. She even started a hashtag where she said it was hashtag public school proud. And she said, I was made in public schools. I taught at public schools. But she was pretty silent on where she sent her kids to school. So that was really what started, that really got me started on looking into this. And then, a week or two after I figured this out about Alex, the Federalists or the Washington Free Beacon and the Federalists, one of them two, found out that Alex continued through his private school career, because I only figured it out for fifth grade. That was the only yearbook I had access to. So a lot of people were responding, well, maybe he only went that 1 year, but that wasn't actually the case. They found the rest of the yearbooks, and he started in fifth grade in private school and finished in 12th grade in a private school in Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania private school was actually in current dollars, it's around $40,000 per year. So very elite schools. The hypocrisy comes in that Warren has come out very hard against school choice, particularly private school choice and charter schools. So she exercised school choice for her own son in sending him to a private school. And I respect that choice. I am glad that she found the best education for her kid possible, but she shouldn't turn around and fight as hard as possible against allowing the less advantaged populations in society to do the same thing. So that's where the hypocrisy comes in. And then it even gets worse. A week or two after that, she did a rally in Atlanta about uplifting, you know, African Americans' voices, and I can get behind that message for sure. But then what was strange at that rally, there was a group of parents, mostly African American parents, protesting against Warren at that rally in Atlanta. Because of her views on educational choice, because she's essentially she wants to take away educational options from disadvantaged families. There actually was a video that surfaced. Warren talked to those parents after the rally understand what they wanted from Warren. And I'm glad that Warren took that opportunity to talk with those people, but the whole conversation, 16 minutes or 17 minutes, was recorded and uploaded on Facebook Live. And I came across the video and found that, you know, about three quarters of the way into the video, Elizabeth Warren lied to one of the moms. The mom confronted Elizabeth Warren and said, hey, you know, we just want the same kind of options that you had for your kids. Because I read somewhere, it was my New York Post article that she read, that you sent your own kids to private schools. And Warren quickly snapped back and responded, no, I sent my kids to public schools. So she lied on camera to the face of this woman. And so that really blew up. And I think a lot of people were upset about that, even people on the left, because you don't lie to a prospective voter like that. And it must have been the case that, you know, it must have been one of two things. One, Warren must have not known that the yearbook photo was out at that point, because it had only been out for a few weeks or a month. Or she just thought that even though it was being recorded, no one was going to catch her quick white lie. But we caught her in the act. And so that's, you know, the two, three big things that have kind of been going on with me over the past couple of months.
So it brings you kind of new attention, and, you know, it's interesting. And that's why I love following you on Twitter, is that you're always digging in there. You know, it's the interesting parts of going further and going farther. And I think you even, you know, put something up recently, you know, towards the end of the year about the different candidates for president, you know, and where they went to school, and, you know, and the choices that their parents made for them, and, you know, and some of those interesting things. And I'm really interested in just, you know, kind of maybe this idea of what you've learned and what you've become convinced of as you've done research. You know, there, you probably predisposition maybe, you know, for school choice and for some of those options. But what have you learned about schools and education? And, you know, you talk about the money stuff, where money's increased. And so what are you learning about research? And then kind of that second question is, like, what are you really interested in discovering, you know, in your own research or other people's research? Or what are the questions that you're asking as we kind of go into this new year and new decade?
Yeah, so I've obviously learned a lot about the research. I presented a lot of this research at the annual summit that you guys had in D.C. But the long-term outcomes associated with school choice are very positive, especially when you start looking at things like reductions in teen pregnancies, reductions in crimes, increases in educational attainment, civic outcomes. We talked on the last podcast about how Horace Mann had it all wrong. The private schools are actually better at producing a well-educated populace and good citizens. So I think when people look at school choice, the first gut reaction is to look at the test score outcomes. And those, admittedly, tend to be positive. Out of the 16 experiments on the subject linking private school choice to test scores, 10 of them find statistically significant positive effects for some or all of the students in the sample. Only two of them, both from the highly regulated Louisiana program, actually find statistically significant negative effects on test scores. But even the positive effects are not all that large. So most of the evidence typically says that there's no difference or there's small positive effects on test scores. But when you start looking at these longer term outcomes that I mentioned, the effects are more positive, and the effect sizes are larger and more positive. And I think that's because parents care way more about these longer term outcomes than they care about test scores. If you survey parents and ask them why they chose one particular school over another, they overwhelmingly rank things like safety and culture and religiosity of the schools at the top, where they rank things like standardized test scores near the very bottom. If you want just one example of this, Lindsay Burke at Heritage Foundation and Jason Bedrick at EdChoice did a 2018 survey in Florida of around 13,000 parents using their education savings accounts. And they found that test scores were at the very bottom. Only 4% of the parents that they interviewed or surveyed listed standardized testing as the reason for choosing a school in one of the top three reasons, not even the top reason. So I think that's why school choice tends to be more positive on these longer term outcomes. As far as researching school choice, I really think that we should look more into these longer term outcomes. We don't have as many studies on longer term outcomes, and that's particularly because of student privacy issues. It's just much more difficult to get the data. For example, linking private school choice to crime, although there are 6 studies linking school choice in general to crime, whether that's a charter school or private school choice program, there's only one study of a private school choice program linking private school choice to crime. And that's the study I did with Patrick Wolf of the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program. We found significant reductions in crime in the long run. I think we need to do some more of these evaluations, but again, it's really hard to do that. I'm working with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement and the Florida Department of Education right now with Patrick Wolf to do a similar study in Florida where we control for a bunch of differences to see the effects of the Florida Tax Credit Scholarship Program on crime. And we're moving the process along, and it's looking positive. We'll need some more approvals at the higher levels, but I think that'll be the next big study linking private school choice to crime if we can get that approval. But also, I think it's important to look at the negative effects or potential unintended consequences of regulating private school choice programs. I've done a few of these studies, but there's not a ton of research out there. Done some of these studies with Patrick Wolf and Lindsay Burke, where we randomly assign, we send surveys out to private school leaders, and we ask them if they would participate in a hypothetical school choice program the next year, a voucher program. And we say, hey, look, we send one group a control condition where we say, look, you won't have to adhere to any government regulations, no additional government regulations to participate in this program. But then we randomly assign various regulations to different private school leaders, such as, hey, you're going to have to take all students and use a random admissions process. You're going to have to take the state tests, or, hey, you're going to have to accept the voucher amount as full payment. And we also randomly assign a nationally norm reference testing regulation as well. And we find that most of these regulations actually reduce the likelihood that the private schools will participate in the program, because that's an additional cost that they don't want to deal with. And the biggest deterrent of private schools from participating in programs is the random admissions mandate, saying that you have to take all kids at random, you can't have any admissions criteria. And that we found about a 70% reduction in the likelihood of saying that you're certain to participate in a program in Florida in our first study of this. So that's a huge reduction. And it doesn't matter what the reason is for the private school leader saying no. The reality is private school leaders like to have autonomy and like to be able to control their mission of their school, their specialization of their school, their student body. And no matter what the reason is, the reality is that these regulations eliminate a bunch of options that low-income students would have otherwise had. So I think we need to think more about these unintended consequences of regulations. We also found some evidence in our studies that these regulations don't only reduce the total amount of options available to low-income students, but they also tend to reduce the likelihood that higher quality schools are participating in the program. So the intention of the regulation sometimes is to increase the quality of the schools that participate, but the unintended result is that the highest quality schools say, screw it, I can already stay financially sustainable without the voucher program. So they're more likely to say no when faced with regulations, whereas the lower quality schools, the ones that are, you know, need the money and they're really strapped for cash, they'll take the voucher funding no matter what type of regulations. So the unintended result is that the average quality level of the private schools actually goes down, is what we're finding in some of these studies at least. So I think we should look into that more, and we should also look into, you know, just the value of standardized test scores, and should we regulate schools based on them? If the standardized test scores aren't good proxies for long-term outcomes, which I have found in some of my research that they are not, we shouldn't regulate schools based on standardized test scores, because then we can actually reduce or harm the long-term outcomes associated with school choice by trying to control quality in the short run.
It's a cool stuff, because what you've discovered and the research that you and many of your colleagues are doing is so much further advanced than when I kind of got into this and got interested in this, you know, 10, 15 years ago. So it's fun. And I think there's that same idea of, you know, just asking and continuing to ask the questions, because, you know, the podcast and the conversation, it's, you know, like you get the UVA, you know, dean and professor and like, you know, the dishonesty about it. And for us to be able to say, okay, here's what we know and here's what we've discovered and here's what we'd like to continue to know, because then how do you put together the right policies? And I think one of the questions, you know, even in this, as you look towards this election, as we're going forward, and as you look to policy, you know, we come out of an era, you know, it's really the era that I grew up in as a professional, is the No Child Left Behind era, where, you know, accountability and standards, and it was the era of charter school growth. It was the era of, you know, a lot of really neat things that I got to see and got to be a part of, but we're seeing a new era begin, or, you know, we're kind of seeing a waning of even interest in certain things. And, you know, and you're watching as the unions try to figure out, well, where's our place in this? And so then there's kind of fights and all this. And so as we look to an election, and as we look to policy, and as we look to a new era of maybe some of this, like, what would be the things that you would care about, or you would say to a voter, hey, pay attention to this, or, you know what, here's some really cool things that are happening as we look forward into maybe this transitionary phase as we get into kind of new policy era in education?
Yeah, there are various legislatures, you know, across the U.S. that are trying to pass universal school choice programs. So I think that's the next step forward, is to try to get a state to pass a universal program. And what I mean by universal is being available to everybody, regardless of your income or background or your parental situation. And I think that's the way forward for school choice, because we've been trying to do this limited targeted program thing for a long time. You know, we have the Milwaukee program. It's been around for three decades now, 2020. It's started in 1990. And the number of the percentage of the school age population that currently uses a private school choice program is still below 1%. And we've had private school choice for three decades now in the U.S. So that approach isn't working, in my opinion. But you mentioned a little bit about this, you know, the test score stuff and the No Child Left Behind. We kind of No Child Left Behind didn't work. We're all kind of sick of the No Child Left Behind stuff. And I think one way that we could move forward with the teachers unions actually is to embrace the idea that standardized testing is not a good measure for actual quality of a school. And so, like, I've actually had Diane Ravitch, who has blocked me on Twitter, in my first exchange with her because of our vehement disagreements, and because she didn't like the evidence that I presented. But that's another story for another day. But she actually blogged about how Jay Green, who's typically a school choice supporter, and myself coming out against standardized test scores and not wanting to regulate private school choice based on standardized test scores. Diane Ravitch actually said, look, we must have something right when both sides of the aisle can actually agree on something. And I think a lot of people are starting to understand that standardized test scores aren't the end-all be-all of education, that kids are more than test scores, that parents care about a lot more than test scores. They care about the climate of the school, the character education going on in the school, and the long-term outcomes of the students. So I think we should embrace that unity that we can have across the aisle with both sides of, you know, both major parties. And even Tony Bennett, who's a Democratic presidential candidate, said at one of the public education forums that was put on by the union, and he pointed out that, look, we're not doing accountability right. We're just looking at average test scores. That's totally irrelevant, to quote what he said. He said it's totally relevant like three times. He said that, look, you need to control for differences in students, or else you're just, you know, harming the schools that are serving the least advantaged kids. And so I kind of tweeted out that Tony Bennett got it half right there, in that if you're going to use test scores as a metric for success, you should at least control for differences in students. But one, he's wrong on two counts. One, because, you know, test scores aren't strong proxies for long-term outcomes. But then two, even if you control for differences in students, we don't have many measures that can actually capture the effects of the school. So, like, for example, we have the measure of free and reduced lunch status. And so you can control for the percent of students that are on free and reduced lunch status, but there's a lot of variation in that indicator variable. You can be a free and you can have two non-free and reduced lunch status students and have one that's really close to the cutoff, and you can have one that's a really well-off family. So even if you're controlling for that, you're still not making apples to apples comparisons. So I think that's a way to move forward, is to kind of build on those connections. But then also, I think for school choice in general, we need to be pushing for more universal programs so that look, you know, most kids don't have school choice in the U.S. today, and we need to change that. And the best way to change that is to, you know, give everybody school choice, allow everyone, no matter what your background is, to take your education dollars to the best school for your own kid.
So let me get a prediction before we finish. If there was a state that was going to go all in on, you know, giving parents that opportunity, students that opportunity, do you envision in the next 10 years a certain state or, you know, that would maybe go in on a broader choice program?
That's a tough call, but my eyes are on Florida. They already have a ton of school choice right now. I think they have over 100,000 students using a private school choice program already. So they're already used to it. They've already shown that school choice can work for a bunch of families. So I think that would be a good place to look towards if you're looking, you know, if you're looking at a particular state. But it's really hard to guess these things, you know, like even Texas couldn't get a special needs private school choice program passed in 2017. They went universal at first, and their legislature was, you know, around three quarters Republican, and they still couldn't get it passed. And then they tried to get a special needs program targeted just to the least advantaged students, and they couldn't get that either in Texas. So it's really hard to predict what's going to happen, especially with unions at play, and especially with if you're talking about rural Republicans who you know, are under a lot of pressure from their superintendents in their district. So it's hard to predict, but I would be looking towards Florida.
Very cool. Corey, happy 2020, and thanks for your time, man.
Thanks. You too, Eric. It's always good to talk to you. And, hey, get your butt up to D.C. soon.
I'll be there soon.